Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. I've got Matt Zernzak and Tim Nebel with me tonight from the Push Podcast. I'm excited to have you guys here. How are you guys doing?
Good. Good. Excited to be here.
Doing great.
Right on. Yeah, it's been a minute since I talked to you, and it'll be the first time you guys have been on my podcast, so it's kind of fun to trade back and forth a little bit.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tonight I wanted to get you guys on. I've been meaning to do some bow tuning podcasts, and I'm going to get Ryan Sampe and one of my employees, Jake Morris, on here to do a kind of a more traditional style. It's kind of funny, traditional style, traditional right. bow, right? So right. It'll be a bolt down or take down recurve or long bow and a one piece. So basically a fixed tiller style traditional bow versus what we're going to talk about tonight, which is ILF. And so I think what we'll do, is I'm going to play the newbie here, and we'll approach it from the angle that, I've shot a compound for years, and I'm interested in getting into traditional archery. And, if you guys could explain to me, what the advantage and disadvantages are of ILF versus a fixed tiller bow.
Yeah, absolutely. So coming over from a compound, if you're making the jump, you know, there's what we're finding is there's two categories of guys wanting to convert. There's the guys that want to get as far away from the higher end, more modern technology as possible. So they're getting into like the bolt down and the one piece bows. But then there's also guys that are really looking into like the metal risers or the wooden risers that have the ILF limb attachment system, just because they like that adjustability. And so they're kind of divided into two camps, and we get a lot of questions flooding in on both sides of, you know, both different camps. You're seeing that trend too as well, right, Tim?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So the big thing with a one piece and a bolt down, why that looks really attractive to one of these camps of archers is it's simple. Traditional archery, that's why people are flooding over to traditional archery. It's you and the bow, it's no mechanisms, and it's just simple, you know. But once you start diving into the details, as a lot of people find, you know, within a couple weeks of surfing the internet, getting ready to take the plunge, the devil's in the details. And there's a lot that actually goes into a single string bow, a simple stick and string, right? So with the bolt down and the one piece bow, you're basically tuning the arrow to the bow. And that's your only way to get a perfect tune. And bare shaft tuning or paper tuning are the big indicators of what your bow is actually doing when you're tuning that arrow and when you're shooting that bow. And the goal here is to get the arrow to recover as quickly as possible after it detaches from the string. As your limbs come to brace, your arrow is sent into its paradox. You want that arrow to recover as quick as possible and fly true to the target. And like I said, paper tuning and bare shaft are two of the main tools or exercises you can go through, and you'll probably get into that in great detail with Sampe and Jake for sure. So the big difference between ILF, it's the limb attachment system. When that bow is fully strung, you can't tell the difference. The way it shoots, you can't tell the difference. The way it looks, the way it feels. But when you unstring the bow, before you brace that bow, the limbs are extremely sloppy in the pockets. And that can deter some people, because you kind of look at it and you're, oh man, this is a little nerve wracking.
Yeah. Feels first like they're going to fall off.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For sure. And we had on our podcast just recently, we just launched a new format called Coaching Moments, where we dive into the weeds with people on targeted specific subject matter. And one of the ones that we just did with John Work from Lancaster Archery was ILF bows. And one thing I didn't realize the feature is what an ILF bow is basically is on the limb side. The limb has a U-channel, a fork on the very butt end of the limb, and that fork is what straddles the tiller bolt. And a little bit up the limb, a certain geometry is a certain distance up the limb towards the tip, still in the fade out, still in the wedge of the limb, the butt of the limb, is a small counterboard hole with a dovetail bushing pressed in from the belly side of that limb. And so that is basically your attachment system. And on the riser side, you have a dovetail coming in from the end of the limb, and then the tiller bolt, obviously, that the fork of
limb coming straps. In from the end of the riser.
Coming in from the end of the riser. Yep. What did I say?
Limb.
Sorry.
No worries.
So when you snap that thing in, that dovetail basically comes in and seats into the dovetail groove, and the fork is just straddling that tiller bolt. So you can tap the end of your limb, and that thing just rocks along that dovetail that's a couple inches up from the butt of your limb. So it feels really unsecure. And when you're stringing the bow, you're kind of wincing a little bit the first time you string an ILF bow. You're like, is this limb going to slide out of this pocket? You know, it's really detractive if you're looking to get into the simplicity. But once you string the bow, the weight of that bow limb trying to pull that and stretch that string completely seats everything. And it's a full, nice, robust system, and it's been around for a very long time. The ILF system was developed by Hoyt. It was the Hoyt dovetail system to begin. They then licensed it out to other manufacturers, and then that's whenever it became the ILF system, the International Limb Fitting or International Limb Fitment. And so this geometry is mostly standardized across the globe, and some of the benefits of ILF is I can take the wonderful Stalker Apex ILF bow, the riser, and I can snap South's limbs, his ILF limbs on it. I can take a pair of Sebastian Flute, TradTech, Win and Win, Hoyt, any bow manufacturer that makes limbs that conform to the ILF geometry. I can just snap them in. And that's one of the big benefits of ILF is the swappability, if you will, of all the different styles and all the different manufacturers out there across the globe.
And to go even further with that, then we were talking about the advantages of that system. If you have during your tuning process, if you have say a 500 shaft, you know, whatever your specs are, if you have a 500 shaft and you have 300 grains up front and your bare shaft is still showing a little bit weak at that point, you're like, well, man, what do I do at this point? I don't want to put a brass insert in there. I can't possibly add any length to my shaft. You can play with your center shot on that bow. If you have an AccuTune on there, some different kind of side plate, you just have more adjustability now, pertaining to that arrow than you wouldn't have if you just had a solid shelf with no adjustability that way. So as Matt said, you can now tune your bow to the arrow. And it's more relates to guys coming over from the compound side because they're used to doing that. They're used to moving their ripcord or their QAD rest back and forth. You know, when now they come to a solid shelf with a solid side plate and they can't do that. So this is more, maybe a little more attractive to some of those guys.
Yeah, that, or you can move your draw weight up or down a little bit too to kind of stiffen or weaken your spine there as needed also.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. And we can get into a little bit of the details of using a case study of tuning up an ILF bow here in a little bit if you'd like to, South.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the nice thing with the interchangeability of the ILF risers and limbs, it's just really nice to be able to have a set of really beautiful, high-end, high-performing limbs, like from you, South, with your Stalker Apex setup. Now, I might have blown my archery budget on that bow, right? I got the dream bow. I saved up for 6 months. I got on your waiting list. Everything's good to go. The bow finally arrives. It's exactly what I need. I tune the thing up. I go and hunt all season long. It performed great. And then now it's winter time and I like to shoot indoor, right? So you want to go in and you're standing on a line, you're shooting 60 arrows in a row and you're working on your form and you just might want a lesser set, a lighter weight set of limbs, but you don't want to pay the money to get another full custom set of limbs. right? So now you can go onto RMS Gear or Lancaster, look at their catalog, and you can order a cheap set of $100 Sebastian flute limbs that are, you know, have kind of the target laminates, the graphics underneath the glass that are just, maybe they're 35 pounds and you'd like to hunt with 50 pound limbs. Now you can just snap those on and they're made by a completely different manufacturer from across the globe and they're going to fit into South's riser. And now you have a nice light set of limbs for training, working out, working on your form. It just makes it nice during the off season that you have that swappability. For my personal bow collection, I think I'm up to, I'm about five or six ILF risers. And probably 8 sets of limbs. So I think
I have that many arrows.
right. But if you start looking at that, I mean, they all match with each other. So at the end of the day, I mean, that's 40 different bow combinations I can make down in my, like the options are infinite. It's mm-hmm. it's ridiculous. So that's such a nice benefit of being able to swap and trade. And then, you know, like Logan Glassburn, our good buddy of the push, he just got a brand new set of limbs from Morrison Archery. I'm kind of interested in those limbs. I'd like to try them out, but I might not want to try them out on his particular riser. I might have a riser that's comfy for me and I want to try them out on my riser. All you do is unstring the bow and it's a 2-finger operation. You're pulling that dovetail out of its fully seated position. That's the butt of the limb is tucked in nicely to the riser. It pulls out with 2 fingers. And I can put them right into my riser, string it up, and away you go. It's just, it's really no more losing your Allen keys. It's basically what it comes down to.
You brought up Logan too. And as soon as you brought up Logan, I thought, you know, Logan is one of those guys that, geez, he probably, if there's how many days in April, 30 days in April, 31 days in April, Logan's going to run through 30 bows this month, probably. Or, I mean, in all actuality, maybe 10. He might go through 10 bows. He's, you know, one of those guys that's constantly buying, constantly selling bows. And the fact that you can interchange these limbs now, and there is that standard where they'll fit on different risers, it opens up a resale world to you. Where if Logan wanted to call bow company XYZ and order a custom set of limbs, and you know, have them mated to his riser, he can't sell those limbs. You know, right. He'd have a really hard time selling those limbs. Where if he, you know, gets $300-$400 set of ILF limbs and they don't work out for him, you know, he can sell those. So
yeah, that's a really good point, Tim, because South, you're going to start seeing as your Apex line gets out in the market more and more on the online classifieds, on all the you know, Trad Gang, Trad Talk, Archery Talk, on those classifieds, you're going to start seeing a lot of the Stalker ILF limbs themselves popping up, and it's going to start creating this market of people buying your limbs, and you're probably going to start seeing pictures of your beautiful custom limbs maybe on a metal riser or on somebody else's manufactured riser. You know, when I first got your prototype Apex set up before you built me my Black Beauty, I had your set of limbs on a 25-inch competition metal riser. And I was running fully string walking on them, seeing how they performed on, you know, that length, on mm-hmm. that length of a bow. And I was running a 68-inch bow with your long set of ILF limbs, which is really, really neat.
Yeah. No, that's something else. that is the cool thing, you know, about ILF is it does offer you so many options. And one thing, kind of following back up with the point you guys had made about the toolless feature of the ILF as far as from a, you know, taking it down. I get a lot of guys that ask, maybe not a lot, maybe that's an overstatement, but I get a number of guys who ask, you know, about, well, you know, I'd like to have a one piece just because I don't want to deal with, you know, having to have an Allen wrench if I'm up backpack hunting or something sure, and lose right. it or whatever. But, you know, for me, it is a nice, you know, I have forgotten my Allen wrench and fortunately had a buddy in camp who had one and bummed it off of him to assemble my bow. So it is a nice feature there. And, you know, to take it apart, backpack in with your bow completely taken apart in your pack and then not have to worry about having that, you know, when you get up there in the field. So it is, there is, you know, certainly advantages of that. And then, so let's dive into a little bit more on the tuning end of it there. If
yeah,
you don't,
absolutely.
Guys don't mind.
So before we go there, South, can I ask you a question?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of boyers out there, you'll hear them be a little hesitant to get into the ILF world. What made you take the plunge to dive into the ILF world? Because, you know, it kind of potentially someone could just buy your riser and not buy a complete bow.
Sure. Yeah.
So what made you want to play in that playground?
Well, there are a couple things. One is I always like to challenge myself. And, you know, not to say that I don't challenge myself on a daily basis building, you know, the bows that I'm building, but, you know, coming out with a new model is a, you know, different level. Every time, you know, I come out with a new bow model, it kind of challenges me to think outside, you know, what I'm doing on a daily basis there. As far as once your jigs are set up, then you're just kind of going, right? And so it is fun to design, a new product. And then, you know, I saw, kind of what was offered from a ILF handle standpoint out there on the market. And I thought that I could build something that would really offer, you know, a similar functionality to a lot of the metal risers and a superior functionality to a lot of the wood risers. And I felt like I could aesthetically, offer a lot more than what was out there on the market. And so that was a big motivation, you know, for myself. And then from a limb standpoint, I just didn't see a lot of, you know, of really what I, you know, what would call pretty limbs. You know, there's a lot of black glass. There's a lot of carbon. There's a handful of wood limbs that are available, but not all that much. And certainly nothing. I mean, there's a lot of boyers that build beautiful bows, take down bows. And I feel like that hasn't transferred over to the ILF market yet. And I thought, you know, if I could be one of the, and I don't want to, you know, say by any stretch, I would be the first guy in doing, you know, offering those things. But there's, you know, I think that most of the boyers that were building veneered limbs, have for whatever reason stopped doing it. And, you know, maybe I'm a little slow here and, I'll figure out why they stopped soon. But, you know, I felt like there was a market for what I could offer. And that's kind of why I dove in.
That's cool. Are you selling many risers by themselves without limbs?
Yeah, I would say probably 40% of the ILF orders are just risers with no limbs. But I'm getting a lot of them, you know, that are complete bows or complete bows with two sets of limbs. So it's been good. I mean, you know, considering how little, I had out there for a sample size for people to, you know, kind of get their hands on it. I mean, I put the word out and you guys certainly helped there. And I was getting guys that are calling up ordering, you know, and no questions asked, I want one, you know, and it wasn't like there weren't, you know, necessarily the degree of investigation maybe that, and some guys certainly did, you know, they're asking all kinds of questions, but some guys were like, man, I just want one. I've seen it. I've seen pictures. I want one. Put me on the list, you know, get it done as soon as you can. Yesterday would be better, you know, kind of like that. So that's the way it is for most guys anyway, but no, it's been a really warm reception. And you know, I think that as more and more of these get out there and more people can put their hands on them, I'm getting a little concerned on how I'm going to keep up because I'm already having a hard time.
You know, and that's arguably, South, that's a market that you tapped into that you weren't going to play in. Begin that was that 40% of people buying those risers, they weren't going to buy a complete bolt down bow from you.
Sure.
I know personally one of the guys that bought a riser from you, he has a set, you know, a brand of ILF limb that he just loves, and he's not going to shoot any other set of limbs, and he loves the adjustability of ILF. But, you know, you just offered him another option of to get, you know, the way you designed your ILF rig with the hidden pocket. I mean, it looks like a custom bolt down. It looks very traditional. You just opened up that market and gave that guy an option. He's like, heck yeah, I'm buying one of those things. Sure. You know, it's great.
Yeah. I mean, I think that some boyers might be a little bit offended, you know, if they're buying parts from you, not buying a complete bow, but right. You know, I'm totally okay with it. It's like, hey, I mean, I think it's a pretty neat thing. And I've been playing around with other manufacturers' limbs here in the shop to see how they shoot and see how they fit and all that. I probably have almost as many limbs from different manufacturers in the shop as I do my own at this point.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah. That's good. So tuning, right? You wanted to go into tuning?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Timmy, stop me if I'm talking too much, right?
Okay, stop. I'll take over from here.
All right. So this is where ILF shines, in my opinion, South. And you know this. This is the tunability and adjustability of an ILF rig is unmatched in the traditional archery realm. So the nice thing about ILF here, the main features, is center shot adjustment on a more modern materialed bow. The ease of that, and I can touch on that real quickly. Weight adjustment, tiller adjustment, and lateral limb adjustment. Those four are major factors in a micro tune of a bow. And when I say micro tune, I feel like bear shaft tuning at that 10 to 15 yards is kind of a coarse tune. And when you get to that 20 to 25 yards, you're medium tune. But when you can group a bear shaft with your fletch shafts out at that 30 yard plus mark, that's whenever you are fully micro tuned. You've taken all the nuances out of that rig, and that arrow recipe is perfectly matched with that bow. So let's get into center shot. So with a more modern material ILF rig, a metal riser, the center shot of those bows, they have a plunger hole, and the center shot's typically pretty drastic. It's over the 3/16 of an inch. I mean, we're talking 1/2 inch, 3/4 of an inch of center shot, because you have a plunger that is going to come in and fill that void. And it gives you arguably infinite adjustability of your center shot for tuning your bows or tuning your arrow recipe to your bow. We offer a AccuTune adjustable side plate. There's plunger on our website. There's plungers that you can buy from RMS Gear and Lancaster Archery. But those are options to adjust your center shot and basically change the dynamic reaction of your arrow and how it paradoxes and clears your shelf. And that's really nice feature. For the Stalker Apex, that's a more traditional bow. You're shooting off the shelf with a fixed side plate. What do you cut? Are those 3/16 past center? South?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you have a fixed center shot. And so outside of sticking a toothpick in behind your shelf material, you're pretty much contained to a standard traditional bow from a center shot adjustability. It's no different than a one piece or a bolt down bow. Weight and tiller. Okay. This is where the tiller bolts come into play. So what you basically do traditionally, Tim touched on this a little bit earlier, was tuning a traditional bow, you're tuning the arrow to the bow. So if you're shooting 50 pounds at your draw length of 28 inches, you kind of go by the books. You might look at arrow charts or look online or ask your buddies on, you know, what spine. You might think, I need to be in a 400 roughly full length with a 250 grain up front. Tip, field tip, or broadhead, because that's what you want to shoot. So you come out, you shoot the bow, and your bear shaft tuning, let's say at 20 yards, and you hit a foot to the right with a knock left, indicating that you have a weak spined arrow. So the only thing you can do there really is increase your center shot or start trimming your arrow or lighten your tip weight. And I'm sure Ryan and Jake will go into a whole lot more detail on the tuning of a traditional bow. Well, you start that process of going into your basement, you cut a 1/2 inch off your arrow, you reset up and you shoot again. You might have brought it in from 12 inches to the right to 8 inches to the right. And you iterate that process until you get that bear shaft shooting down the middle and grouping with your flat shafts. But with a ILF rig, the nice thing about it is you can, especially if you have the center shot adjustability, you can infinitely tune any arrow, really, you within reason. So you can take that arrow and say, you know what, with my point on, if I'm an aimer, I know I want to have a 29 inch arrow, I want to shoot 250 grains up front, and I want this much FOC, so I'm going to try to run a 500 out of this arrow, out of this bow. And so you dream up this arrow recipe, and you can almost cut that arrow to that 29 inch length, set it up with the bear shaft, and start the tuning process. And now you're not tuning the arrow to the bow, you're tuning the bow to the arrow, which is really neat. So when you get to that point where you have a 8-inch, 6-inch right impact showing weak, what you can do with the ILF rigs is you have weight adjustability. So you can pop the set screw on the belly side of the riser and start turning out the tiller bolts, which is basically changing the preload of the limbs and also the angle of attack or the preload angle of the butt of the limbs. And you're changing your draw weight. And a standard traditional bow rule of thumb is you get about 5% of your draw weight up, 5% down. So with that 50-pound bow example at 28 inches, if you're roughly right in the middle of your tiller bolt travel, you will get about 2.5 pounds up and 2.5 pounds down of adjustability of draw weight at your draw length. So that makes it really nice that if you're shooting weak and your draw length or your draw weight is 50 pounds, you can go down to 47.5 pounds and bring that bear shaft in just a touch, just enough to get yourself to that final tune, which is really, really nice.
Yeah. I think I heard you say a few weeks ago that you hate cutting arrows now. Like, you'll do everything you possibly can before you actually have to cut a shaft.
Oh, I hate it.
With an ILF rig, yeah.
Yeah, I'm currently tuning my summer 3D and in field bow for competition. It's a 27-inch metal riser with long set of limbs, and I have full-length 600-spine VAP arrows with 80-grain glue and tips, right? This whole arrow weight is like 365 grains, and I refuse to cut that arrow right now.
So because you have a full length shaft, your gaps are also smaller now, right?
That's right. That's right. The longer I can keep that arrow, the better my sight picture is for 3D, particularly. Right. For field, you want your arrow pretty short. You know, you're shooting a lot longer distance, so a point on of that 50-yard range is really nice. But for 3D, we're 30 yards and in. I do everything I possibly can to not cut that arrow, and I try to tune that bow. I exhaust all my options to tune my bow to that arrow recipe before I'll succeed or concede to going in and turning on the arrow saw.
Right.
So, anything there, Sal?
No. I think that's all excellent. Let's talk about. I'm interested. I mean, I haven't played around much with bows with adjustable side plates. So, you know, coming from the compound world, it was, you know, line it up center line. And then, and then that's basically what you're doing to get your center shot there. And then you work from there. But obviously you're shooting a release primarily, with a compound. So you don't get that paradox so much coming out of a compound. As you do the radical paradox coming out of a stick bow. When you're, and I guess this kind of, you know, this is not, serving to stalker shooters per se. Talk about, moving your center shot out. You're going to then be needing a weaker spine versus moving it in and needing a stiffer spine. Maybe for some of the guys that are shooting a metal handled bow that do have that plunger adjustment.
Yeah. I mean, you said it right there. I mean, there's not a whole lot of details or a whole lot of mystery behind it. We offer a product called the AccuTune. It's on our website. And what it basically is it's an adjustable side plate. It has a barrel on the opposite side of the shelf of the riser window, sight window. And you pop open the set screw, and that allows the barrel to turn. And as you turn that barrel, that side plate is translating left and right in as viewed from the archer side, you know, and it's just running that side plate across your shelf left and right, adjusting your center shot with every turn of that barrel. And what you're doing is you're basically changing the center of the bow. And when you have a weak arrow, your arrow needs to wrap around your sight window to get on course to head straight down the middle. And what you'll find is if you're shooting in that bear shaft example that we've been talking about a little earlier, and you're hitting that 3-4 inches to the right of where you're wanting to hit, that's showing a weak arrow recipe. So what I like to do is give a few cranks on that AccuTune and bring my center, lessen the center shot. And when you're lessening the center shot, you're making that arrow wrap around that AccuTune or that side plate more. And it makes that arrow get on course heading straight down the middle. And conversely to that, the same, if you're showing stiff, then you can increase your center shot, so coming more towards the sight window of the bow. And if you're impacting to the left with a knock right, that's indicating a stiff bear shaft reading. And you can take that, you can take a large majority of that stiff reading and get pretty darn close to the point where you're almost grouping with your fletch shafts. You might have an inch or so to go. And then that's when I move on to my weight adjustability of my ILF. So I use the center shot to take a large majority of that out of tuneness, if you will, to take that weak reading or that stiff reading out. And then my fine tuning is with my weight adjustment on the ILF.
So let's take it from, maybe I should ask you this from the very beginning, but I think we have a pretty good, you know, background on, you know, what, on, you know, how you tune them. But let's say I have decided to buy an ILF. I've got one in my hands and I have an arrow, you know, my basic arrow recipe that I've got set up. What is going to be the, let's just say you're shooting 3 under, you know, versus what you guys are doing, the fixed crawl. What are you going to set your knock height at on a preliminary adjustment? Are you going to play with your brace height first? Are you going to use brace height adjustments, fine tuning that after, you know, kind of your work or during the time you're working on your tune, or kind of maybe walk through step by step what you would do there if you're setting up a new bow?
Yeah, for sure. What I do is I typically contact the bowyer. I try to find what their recommended brace height is. And that's the first thing I really pay attention to. So I start it for an ILF rig. I start at even tiller. And if I do have center shot adjustment, what I'll do is adjust my center shot. So if I'm looking at the belly side of the bow from the shooter side, and I close one eye and line the string up down the center of the limb, at the tip of the arrow, I want 1 arrow diameter left of the string. Okay. Is that clear?
Yep.
Okay.
And what's your reasoning for that?
So the reasoning for that is the string is going to have to, when it starts its S path shooting with our fingers, whenever you're at full draw and you release that string, it's having to move your fingers out of the way. And that S path starts off to the left and it starts moving forward. So that's just a preliminary rule of thumb. Starting position is 1 arrow diameter left of the shaft. Now, I don't just keep it there, because during the tuning process, sometimes my arrow is 1 diameter to the right of the string, and sometimes it's 3 diameters to the left of the string by the time I'm all said and done. And sometimes it's right down the middle, where I line up that string right down the middle of that limb, and it's bisecting that shaft perfectly. Mm-hmm. So it's just a starting point.
And that's gonna be dependent on the torque that someone puts on the riser too, you know, by right. Their grip and everything too, for sure.
Absolutely. Great point.
Yeah. And that, yeah. I mean, that really can't be understated. I remember I used to have an archery shop back in the early 90s, and I had a guy come in and he was shooting a compound with a release. And so right there, you're eliminating a lot of variables that you wouldn't have to deal with a, you know, tuning a stick bow. And I remember, you know, after setting up, you know, dozens and dozens or hundreds of bows, you got to where you had a pretty good feel, particularly if it's the same brand or the same model, then you could, you know, usually eyeball everything and you could walk out to the paper and shoot a bullet hole through it, without having to make any adjustments. And so I set this bow up for this kid and handed him the bow, confident that he'd shoot a bullet hole with it. And he shot it through paper and got like a 2-inch left tear. And I was like, what? So, I mean, I was really scratching my head. And so I worked with him. And man, we could not get rid of that tear. And I said, you know, so I moved it back to where it was when I originally set it up. I said, here, let me try it. And boom, bullet hole. And he was torquing that riser so bad that it was, you know, causing that arrow to tear almost 2 inches to the left as it went through the paper from, you know, 3 feet away. And so it is really important to understand that, you know, that you can introduce a lot of problems into your bow, into your tuning, into your shooting, simply by the way you're gripping the bow.
Oh yeah, for sure. Definitely. And how clean, I mean, how efficient is your body at releasing that string and letting those three fingers completely go dead on your string side of your shot? How much S-path are you inducing in that string as you're releasing? Are you a plucker? You know, mm-hmm. are you not shooting with your back? And it's funny because Tim and I will be on our podcast leading up to a hunting season. We'll just start rapping about what our final setup is, right? Oh, we're shooting a 64-inch bow and we're 46 pounds at 28.5 inches. And we start talking about our entire setup because, you know, traditional archers, we're all gear junkies. And it's without fail, we always get emails from guys that are going, I have the same draw length. I'm shooting the same draw weight.
Yeah.
And I bought those arrows. You know, same, so I'm running the same tip weight and I'm hitting 12 inches low and left. What the heck gives? Well,
how are you doing that?
Right. You know, you're shooting, you're torquing your bow differently than I am. You know, our releases are different. I don't know what your center shot is on your bow, what your tiller set up. I mean, there's so many variables. And like we started at the very beginning of this podcast, the devil's in the details. You know, traditional archery seems very simple, you know, looking at the cover of this novel, but oh my goodness. It gets deep.
Yeah, there's a lot you can go into. I mean, you know, how efficient are the limbs on that bow? You know, what's the brace height? You know, I mean, you can get a 50-pound recurve that has a 9-inch brace height, or you can get one that's got a 7.5-inch brace height. Well, that's an inch and a half difference of power stroke of pushing on that arrow. That's going to affect the arrow spine, you know, differently. So there is, you know, quite a few things to take into consideration.
Your limbs on your Stalker South is a perfect example of that. I've been able to get a 500 spine arrow to tune out of any ILF rig with a normal conventional limb design in that 45-pound range. I mean, I like I said, of all those examples I have down in my basement and all those different combinations, I can always get a 500 spine to tune. And that's all I have downstairs is mainly 500 spine arrows.
Mm-hmm.
And I got your Stalker Apex, and that limb, that static tip design is so poppy and so aggressive coming back to brace compared to some of the conventional limb designs that I have down in the basement. And I can't get a 500 to tune to save my life out of that bow.
What's a 400, huh?
Yeah, so once a 400. Wow. So it's just, you know, the different limb geometry, different limb dynamics, mm-hmm. you know,
that yep.
plays into it.
Interesting. Well, I sure derailed us off of our...
No, that's our...
We expected it.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So, okay, so brace height. So I want to get the brace height to the recommended... right in the middle of the range. And then I want to get my my center shot set to one arrow diameter left of the string as I line the string up down the middle of the limbs. And then I also want to check with ILF, I do have the adjustability of lateral limb adjustment. And lateral limb adjustment occurs at the ends of the risers. Typically, it's two set screws coming in from the left and from the right, and it's interfacing with the dovetail pocket that the dovetail on the limb slides into. And what you're doing is translating that dovetail pocket left and right. And at the tip, it's basically moving it left and right. So some sets of limbs might not be perfectly straight, or down on the butt end, the fork might not be manufactured perfect. And you might have some riser twist going on as well. Who knows? I mean, you're taking all these different manufacturers' risers and limbs and trying to get them to work. You're going to have a little bit of mismatch going on with how well does the string track down the center of the limb. Well, with ILF, we have lateral limb adjustment. And so I want to get that set as well. So in the pretty much the same fashion, you can use biter limb gauges. John Wirt gave a really good tip. You can use a ruler and set a masking tape. And you just basically want to find the center of your limb. And when you're viewing it from behind, looking down, lining up, just like we were lining up our center shot, you want to line up the string down the center of the limb, and you might notice one of your limbs might be off kiltered by, you know, maybe a 16th of an inch. It's nice having that lateral limb adjustment to bump that limb over just a touch and get that tracking right down the middle. And then now you're ready to start the tuning process. And so what I would do is I start at an even tiller. So the tiller is the measurement perpendicular to the string from the string to the top of the riser and the string to the bottom of the riser, and you compare those dimensions. Even tiller is those two dimensions are going to be the same, meaning that the limbs are preloaded the same in comparison with each other. And a standard split finger shooter on a standard bolt down or a one piece traditional bow, they typically are usually tillered positive. And that is where the lower limb is preloaded slightly more than the top limb, meaning that the lower dimension is smaller than the top dimension, comparing the distance from the lower part of the riser to the string versus the top of the riser to the string. And the reason why it's smaller is that lower limb is preloaded more than the top limb, so it's pulling against that string and pulling that string closer to the riser. So that's how you know which of your limbs are preloaded more, is that distance, the distance that's smaller between the two measurements. So a positive tiller is for split finger. Even tillers, typically industry standard for starting shooting three under. And during the tuning process, if you're running a fixed crawl or you're a string walker, you might have to go to the negative tiller. And all tillers doing is when you're at full draw and you release that string, it's all about getting those limbs to come back to brace in time with each other. You don't want a second delay between the top limb coming and slamming to brace and then the bottom limb coming a second after it. And then you get this weird noodling effect and you get tons of bow noise and erratic arrow flight. Wherever you're gripping the string or wherever you have hand pressure on your grip, you want the dynamics of that bow. The whole goal is to get the top and bottom limb to come to brace in time with each other. And I usually start at even tiller.
For a split finger guy or a fixed crawl guy like us, whenever you do set that slightly positive or slightly negative, how much are you like, what's the difference there? Like a 16th of an inch, an eighth of an inch?
You asking South that?
Either one. I've never done it. I'm curious to know.
Go ahead, South. When you're building a bolt down, what's the difference? What are you tillering your bolt down or your one pieces at?
So on a split, I'll usually go 3/16, a quarter positive. And then, on 3 under, you know, going even there. And then when they're going fixed crawl, you know, obviously the greater the crawl you have, then the more negative tiller you're going to want. So it's kind of a little bit subject to, you know, I'll have a conversation with the person and ask them, you know, what, if they have a preference, what they want it at, or, you know, if eighth or what.
What did you set my dingo at?
I want to say it was probably an eighth, but I don't remember for sure.
Yeah. It's funny. I haven't measured it.
Mm-hmm. So whenever you are like, I know Matt, you're not setting your ILFs up for split finger or straight up 300, but if you were, you would start out with like a 3/16.
So positive. What I do is, yeah. So taking you through my tuning process is I started even and now I'm ready to start the tuning process. So I've set my brace in the middle of the Boyer's manufacturing. I got my one diameter arrow diameter left of the string is viewing from the belly side of the bow with the string centered. I've adjusted my lateral limb adjustment. I'm ready to start the tuning process. And the very first thing I want to do is get my brace height correct and get my tiller correct. And all that takes is a few shots. If that bow is growling at me, I know that either my brace height is not correct or it's not where it wants to be, or my limbs are out of time with each other. So I tune with a fixed crawl, and it'd be no different if you're tuning three under. If you started at even, you're going to get a little bit of growling going on. So I like to try to find where that, I go to the extremes on the brace height. That's what I try to nail down first. So I start in the middle. I'll go all the way down to the lower end. So South, if you like, if you gave me a recommendation between 7 and 8 inches, I'd shoot my first couple arrows at 7.5, and then I'd instantly plummet all the way down to 7 or even slightly under, like 6 7/8. And I'll shoot a few shots there just to start getting to know the bow, getting to know the character of the bow. Does it like a low brace height? And then I'll skyrocket all the way to the upper extreme as well. And so I want to just get a full spectrum idea of how this bow behaves at those extremes from a brace height perspective. And then you get to know pretty quickly what type of brace height that bow likes. And then that's all in the minutia as you get further on down the micro tuning setup. So if in this instance I found that it liked a higher brace height, I might be up in that 8-inch brace height area for this particular bow model, this imaginary bow we're tuning, right? And then what I'll do is start adjusting my tiller as well as I'm starting to bear shaft. And if that bow is still growling at me, all I'm trying to do is get those limbs in time with each other. And typically fixed crawl shooting, I usually land about an 1/8-inch negative tiller on my ILF rigs.
You know, something to keep in mind, if you are playing around with your grip, you know, how you're holding the riser and where yeah. you're putting, where you're distributing the weight, your pressure from, say, the web of your thumb and forefinger, down to the heel of your hand there, you are effectively, changing your timing on your limbs, because you're basically, if you were to hold, let's just say you grabbed your bow and you held it midway down the bottom limb and you drew that bow, then it's going to pull differently than if you're holding it in the center of the riser. So by shifting the weight from the throat of the grip to the heel of the grip, you are going to be flexing that bottom limb more than the top limb there, because you're changing kind of that pressure point where that fulcrum is on the mm-hmm. on the bow. So it's something to, you know, to kind of keep in mind too for somebody if they're shooting a bow that, you know, is not adjustable in tiller. If you're shooting like with a lot of heavy heel pressure, try shooting more out of the web of your hand and see what happens, because that right there could correct some problems with arrow flight.
Oh yeah. For sure.
An interesting point.
Yeah, my son has a little 20-pound little ILF rig that I have set up for him, a little 58-incher. It's a really cool little bow. And I can draw that thing back to my full 29, 30-inch draw length, and I can, you know, looking into a mirror facing the side profile of the bow, I can put all my pressure on the heel of the bow down at the very palm of my hand, base mm-hmm. of my thumb. And you can, and then I can rotate as I'm at full draw and move all the pressure to a high risk position, like you said, like a, in the web between yeah. my index finger. And I can watch that lower limb completely flexing differently. You can watch those two limbs and how the difference is. It's amazing.
Yeah. And I think that's probably something that a lot of people don't think about. And then also, you know, when you're drawing the bow, you know, shooting with a high, really high elbow, which I'm kind of guilty of myself, I actually induce a lot of torque into the string, shooting with a higher elbow. If you were to look at the string from behind me, it's not perfectly straight now. All of a sudden, it's got a kink in it because that bottom finger is torquing that string so much. And man, I try to get my elbow lower and, you know, to kind of straighten that string out some, because it also digs into that bottom finger quite a bit. And if you get, you know, one of those gnarly calluses on that bottom finger, you're probably shooting, you know, similar to me with that really high elbow.
Mm-hmm. That probably comes from the days with the compound. I struggle with that too. Yeah.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, I don't know where I picked it up, but it could have been part of it trying to stretch my 27.5-inch draw out to 31.
maybe that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And yeah, so like, let's hypothetically say we fast forward through that tuning process, right? That's where we started. We got our tiller set up. The bow's not growling at us anymore. Brace height's perfect. Bear shafts are flying great. Everything's good to go. And you follow through the process that Ryan Sampay and Jake are going to talk to you about in a future episode. And now you have your arrows are perfectly micro-tuned out to 30 yards. You're so happy. Here's what an amazing part of the ILF system is going to give you is then you listen to one of our podcasts with Tom Klum Sr., or you're starting to work on form in the wintertime, or like John Wirt mentioned on our recent Coaching Moments ILF podcast, maybe you're just not in shape anymore. Maybe you kind of came through the winter time and you put some pounds on, you didn't shoot your bow a lot and you picked your bow up. I challenge anybody out there, if you're one of the people that haven't checked your bear shaft tune in over a year, I challenge anyone to take those feathers, slice off the feathers on one of your arrows, and check your bear shaft. You may think you're perfectly tuned because you did that a year ago and you set up your bow, and this is your go-to bow for hunting season. Recheck your bear shaft tune. I will guarantee you, you're not shooting perfectly flying bear shafts like you once thought you were. Now, the benefit of the ILF is you can adjust your rig to keep up with our biomechanic changes, our biology changes over time with these 5% down and 5% up weight adjustments. So I got my bow perfectly tuned. I go through a successful hunting season. I pick up my competition rig. I shoot my competition rig all through the off season. I'm ready to come back to my hunting rig for the 2018 hunting season. And I haven't changed a thing. I'm going to shoot the same bow, same brace height, same arrow recipe. Typically you just say, oh, I'm good. I tuned this last year. We're ready to roll. Shoot a bear shaft. You'll be surprised at the drastic difference, and you haven't changed a thing. Everything's set perfectly. But what you can do with the ILF rig is you shoot that shot for the first time coming into a year later since you've tuned, and you might be 2 to 3 inches impacting weak. Well, now you can just unpop those set screws on your tiller bolt and back the poundage off by a pound and a half, and you can bring that bear shaft right back in. And that's a really nice benefit of the ILF system.
And to follow that up even further, your bear shaft tune can change day to day. You know, not you use the example like from a year ago, but even a day. Like if I buy a dozen arrows and I bear shaft tune them on a Monday, I take them out on Tuesday, they might be a little different. Might be a little different Wednesday, you know, and then Thursday they're back to how they were on Monday. Like it can, you know, we've all seen how our shooting can differ from one day to the next drastically like that. So yeah, if you really extrapolate that out to a year, yeah, it's, I mean, there could be huge changes for sure.
Oh yeah. How many times have you text me or I've texted you, Tim, and just kind of going, oh crap, what a crappy shooting session, man, I'm shooting crap this week, right? If you're shooting like crap this week, something's changed and so is your tune.
Right.
You know, it can just continue to snowball downhill from there. So it's nice to keep up with your live real-time shooting process, shot process, and dynamics of your entire system, you, the archer, the bow, the arrow recipe, and be able to micro adjust your rig to continue to give you perfect bear shaft results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's go ahead, Sal.
I was just going to say, I think that there's, you know, there's several things in there that all go to the reason why you have to shoot a stick bow more frequently than you have to shoot a compound, and why you have to shoot a compound more frequently than you shoot a rifle. The more that you the more human element, you know, involvement that there is in, discharging, you know, the weapon, then the more that you have to, keep your muscle memory and your technique sharp in order to be able to replicate that same thing over and over. I mean, I think that's a strong argument for, you know, a draw check for one. I mean, if you're not shooting something like a clicker or another, mechanism that gets you back to the same draw the same time every time, you're going to be essentially shooting, you know, a different length of power stroke with a different draw weight each time you shoot, and that is going to in turn affect your arrow spine differently each time. And then in addition to that, then you have to think about, you know, if you're applying different grip pressure every time, that's going to also have a small effect on it. And if you're, you know, not releasing the string the same way every time, that's also going to be introducing another inconsistency. And so if you start to compound all these inconsistencies, then all of a sudden, you know, you wonder why you can't hold a basketball sized group at 20 yards.
right. For sure. It's all about taking the machine out of the weapon and you becoming that machine, you know, in traditional archery for sure. Right.
And I think your form can evolve and change in good ways too. You're not every difference in your form from 1 week to the next has to be bad necessarily. Like you can, you know, maybe you are working on your alignment And from 1 week to week number two, your alignment just gets way, way better. Well, that's going to change your tune also.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Your bow arm gets way more steady than it used to be. That's going to change your tune. And then to bring this all back to the main point, an ILF bow, it's going to save you a lot of money in the long run as far as arrows are concerned. You know, you're not going to have to say like, well, geez, like I tuned these arrows in August before archery season. Now we're coming up on turkey season and I can't get these darn things to tune anymore. So I got to spend $150 for, you know, a dozen arrows. It's now it becomes, well, I'm just going to play with my tiller a couple turns. Got it. Problem solved. Right, Matt?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yep, adjust your center shot a little bit, adjust your tiller, and bingo, you're right in there. And that's a really good point, Tim. You know, those improvements working. I mean, our whole listener base right now is following along those coaching moments, and everyone is working on their form collectively as a big family, and it's a lot of fun watching that happening. And like you said, the better you get, because when you tune your bow, if you're consistent, you can have a plucky release and a really horrible bow torque going on in your shot, but if you do it consistently shot after shot, you can tune around that. You can get perfect right. Bear shaft flight as long as you're doing the same thing. But if you go, you know what, I don't want to pluck the string anymore and I don't want to torque my bow excessively anymore, and you start taking that stuff out, yeah, that's a great point, Tim.
Right. New arrows, new broadheads. You know, if you have two dozen 250 grain heads and now you got to go to 200s, that's a lot of money. you gotta buy a quiver full of new broadheads. It's not cheap.
No doubt. I've got 5 gallon buckets filled with arrows upstairs, multiples.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
No doubt about it.
For sure.
Right on. Well, are we missing anything there? Or
I don't think so. That's the full gambit of ILF for sure.
Good deal. Good deal. What, just as a couple of side notes here, let's, what are your guys' preferences on, string silencers?
I think both of us are running the same thing now. We make them ourselves out of just simple yarn. We buy it at the craft store.
Just acrylic yarn?
Acrylic. we have a little ongoing joke here. Mm-hmm. That Matt actually, he'll deny it to the grave, but he actually told me when I got into trad, he told me in the beginning that you have to use wool, actual 100% wool yarn for your silencers, because, and he did tell me this, he told me that it's, you know how wool is, merino wool, a lot of guys will wear it when they backpacking hunts, they're going to be in the backcountry for 2 weeks at a time, that it doesn't harbor bacteria growth and smell. You know, there's no odor associated with that. Mm-hmm. And he told me, I don't know if he was messing with me, but he did say it, that you have to use wool so that your silencers won't smell and spook the game that you're after. But he did tell me that. Now he denies it now. But
as, from a guy that doesn't practice any scent control whatsoever, if a deer is smelling my string silencers, I'm in big trouble, because it would have smelled me a lot sooner than it smelled my string silencers. But yeah, it is a funny inside joke we have going on. But no, acrylic. I use acrylic. I actually, to get it to match my string or my bow, I'll actually make them look a little fancy. Mm-hmm. I'll use a friendship bracelet, like that standard cotton friendship bracelet you could buy at any craft store.
Sure.
They have a giant rack of it, and I'll match it to my string perfectly. So for the dingo, for instance, there's a lot of yellow and greens going on in that bow. I have a yellow and green string, and then I have the black micarta riser. So I have black acrylic yarn, and then I'll thread in some random colors of that green and yellow from that friendship bracelet material, and it makes a really poppy, nice looking string silencer.
Mm-hmm. We all know that you pulled that friendship bracelet material out from a box underneath your bed.
No, I actually used it. I cut the friendship bracelet that Tim gave me after he started.
Okay, let's move on. Moving on. South, I have on that same wavelength, I have a question for you.
Sure.
The, when I got my Coyote from you, the string you sent with it had four silencers, so two silencers on either side of the knocking point.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to me the thought process behind that? Do you see advantages over one versus, you know, two? Or two versus four, rather, I guess I should say.
I found, you know, and we're going to do, so I, I, we've got a little shooting range set up upstairs in my archery room, and we're going to we've got the shooting machine set up and a chronograph set up and all that. So we're going to start doing a bunch of testing. And I would like to find, you know, a decibel meter so that we can, you know, test different string materials, different silencer materials, different limb designs, you know, different tiller settings. Well, I don't know how much the tiller setting will, because you're shooting it out of a shooting machine. So, I don't, you know, it'd be better to shoot that by hand. But in any case, I want to do a bunch of kind of really, you know, quote unquote scientific testing and get some real empirical data so we can see, you know, loss of speed with one set of cat whiskers versus two sets. We can test them against, you know, the beaver balls, test them against yarn, test them against, you know, just a myriad of different types of silencer materials, as well as, you know, a skinny string versus a standard string count, you know, material A versus material B and what have you, and just see how much, you know, is there much of a difference and be able to do that all with the same, you know, shooting at the same bow, same brace height, and stuff. From a silencer standpoint, I think that the four definitely makes a difference over two, but I don't think it's near as much of a difference as two versus none. Mm-hmm. And I expect that we'll see, you know, probably somewhere in that 5 or 6 foot per second loss of speed, you know, with the string silencers on there versus no string silencers. But, you know, also it does help with the string noise quite a bit. So that's the way I've been hunting with. And Ryan Sampe did quite a bit of playing around with it. And that was the kind of the recipe it seemed like he really liked. And I've just kind of followed along there with his testing. But it's something I'd like to check with the chronograph and then, you know, test in it with a decibel meter to see, you know, okay, are the losses in speed worth the gains in the loss of sound transmission.
You could probably save some money on a decibel meter and use your llamas as live test subjects to see if they jump the string.
Yeah. Put some flak jackets on them and
right. But I mean, also you have game in your yard too, so you could probably use some elk or anything. Oh, man. Right?
I'd be tempted to screw a broadhead on the end of it.
Though. No.
Yes, indeed.
Cool.
All right. Well, what's your guys' thoughts? How many you run in 4, 5, or 6 arrow quivers? Back there, you guys probably just do the one arrow quiver, right?
I wish. That's gutsy. I
walk back to my truck. I can usually see it from my tree stand. No, I'm just kidding. I run six.
You run six? Right. I thought you ran five.
No, my dingo has a 5 on it, but all my other every other Selway I own is a 6 arrow.
Gotcha. That's a lot of missing. So I run 5.
So there was a spot we used to be able to hunt back in the 80s. Well, actually, it went all the way up into the 90s before they shot the islands off. But on off the coast of California, there was a couple of islands: Santa Cruz Island and Catalina Island. And particularly on Catalina, I think it was probably more so than on Santa Cruz, but there was a lot of goats that ran around on Catalina Island. So they'd have these three-day weekend hunts you could go on out there. And guys, would go out with 16 arrow quivers, and nice. You'd come back to camp at night empty.
Wow. A great time to me.
Oh man, I one time was I emptied my quiver shooting at a goat and was picking arrows, and there were arrows scattered all over that island from guys shooting, and I can remember lobbing arrows that I picked up off the ground at goats, but it was crazy. But I was thinking I need to get Selway to make me a special, like, a, you know, 1 gallon bucket hood with a, a banana clip for a, right. a quiver clip on there. There's been a couple of times when I've shot my quiver out.
It rotates.
To get to there the back you go. Side. Yep. Yep.
There you go, Drew Bear. That's a little idea for you. Come it's to
the
market.
Next big thing.
Right. Just talking about Catalina at over Easter with my family. Is there a herd of buffalo on Catalina Island?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Yep. So they were talking about that. There's like 400 of them out there.
I'm not sure how many there are. They used to be able to hunt them. And that was, I mean, it wasn't much of a hunt. They weren't very spooky. I mean, I walked up on them one time coming over a rise and almost ran right into a big bull at about 10 yards and talk about a pant wetter, man. Just turned around. Oh, yeah. Fortunately, he didn't see me. And I just backed down the hill there before he noticed me. But I think it was like $2,200 and I mean, what a smoking deal to get a freezer full of buffalo.
Oh yeah.
Sounds like a
Patrick McManus story.
Oh yeah. No doubt. No doubt. In fact, I got to record some more of those this week here. Oh geez. The last one I read, man, I don't think it's aired yet. I was literally had tears streaming down my face. I was dying laughing.
They are really funny stories, but the best part, the funniest part, is whenever you just lose it. You can barely understand what you're saying.
Well, this one I didn't really, you know, before what I was doing when I was recording them is when I'd start laughing, I would stop and then I'd go back. And then, so you guys didn't have the benefit of hearing most of the times when I was really botching things up, but
yeah,
this
don't
last,
stop. Just leave that in.
Yeah. This last one, there'll be a lot of outtakes that I had saved, you know, that he's going to cut out, put at the end. And then it was so stinking funny. It was one that I hadn't read before. So I kind of went out on a limb. It was a sequel to another one of his short stories. And, it was a sequel to The Mountain Car. And I was just dying laughing. My wife just gets like totally sick of it. She's like, I don't even want to hear Patrick McMahon. I don't even want to hear it. Like, I can't understand how she couldn't appreciate the humor like I do. But I know, I guess it's one for, you know, there's different types of comedy for everybody. But man, he gets me just in stitches.
Right.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Yeah. Just keep forcing it on her. Keep reading it to her, and she'll warm up to it.
Yeah. I think I probably thoroughly embarrassed her the first time I met her family. I brought one of the Patrick McManus books to read around the campfire. Surprised she married me.
Right.
I mean, That's funny. Stitches laughing, just about rolling on the ground, and everyone's looking at me like, what is this freak?
What is he on?
No doubt. Well, we kind of liked him in the beginning, but right. Now we're not so sure.
Not so sure.
Yeah.
So, South, complete tangent. When's Stalker in the Backcountry 2 coming out?
You know, we're working on editing it right now, and we're doing some of that in-house with the new guy I just hired. It's a lot more efficient. He doesn't know as much as the other guys I had editing, but he's, you know, learning quickly, and he's able to, you know, cut stuff up, and then I can look right over his shoulder and, okay, shorten this one, lengthen that one, you know, let's look for some more footage for fill-in here or whatever. And so we're lacking a few of the files. And so I've got a hard drive circulating around Oregon right now, collecting the footage, getting mailed from one location to another. And I'm hoping to see it back towards the end of this week. And then once I get it back in possession, we'll be able to kind of get back off to the races on that. And, you know, it's hard for me to say exactly, but it's going to be sometime this summer. And I would really like to have it, what is this, beginning April now. It'd be really nice to have it to bring to CTAS there to the high country shoot. So that's what I'm shooting for. And I'd be, you know, it's one of those things I don't want to rush it, but at the same time, I'm trying to get it out as fast as I can.
Mm-hmm. You think it's a done deal to have it at ETAR? You'll have it in your booth up at ETAR?
Yeah. I mean, I'll be severely disappointed in myself if I don't for that. Right. Yeah, but it's going to be a good one. There's a lot of good footage in there. you know, the camera work is, we have better camera gear, kind of a better knowledge of what we wanted to be shooting. There's still, like, every time we start editing stuff, it's like, oh man, we should have been shooting this or should have got that. And
yep.
So it's a constant learning, you know, process, but, I've got some really good music to add on there. And that's something that I feel really can change the whole feel, you know, of a production is the music that goes into it. And, you know, I'm kind of old school, I guess. I mean, I really like the stuff the Wenzels and Mike Mitten does. And, I'm not such a fan of the headbanger, you know, music. Right. I just don't, I mean, to me, that just doesn't seem congruent with the kind of peaceful feeling that you have when you're out
there. This patient game that we play.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we're excited to see it. Not to take anything away from the tree stand type hunting videos, but just the style that you hunt out there, that's got to be a nightmare to film. I mean, you know, to on stocks like that, if you actually have a camera angle behind you, like, you know, over the shoulder camera angle, that's virtually impossible, I would think.
Yeah, it can be tough. I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff we were shooting through a digiscope, and we actually mm-hmm. did get some footage, some good over the shoulder stuff, last year. I blew it on a shot on a nice mule deer, and my cameraman was right there with me. We were literally standing on the rock, standing on the rim rock, the buck was bedded under, and, you know, the cameraman leans over, and the buck, I mean, he literally could have taken one big step and he'd have landed, you know, just and then been airborne for 15 feet and landed right on the top of the deer. So we got some pretty cool, you know, up close footage, and that's the, to me, I mean, that's really what makes hunting with a stick bow exciting, is when you can get that type of close encounter. And when you're kind of limiting yourself to almost needing to have that, some of the areas that I was hunting, you know, they're big bowls, and so to stalk a buck in the open just isn't going to happen. You have to wait until they're bedded up and have some kind of cover around them that you can use to conceal your approach. And so it's kind of really tailor made, you know, once you find a deer that's bedded in the right spot, it's tailor made really for hunting with a stick bow.
Absolutely. Do you know any guys that self film that style? Not many, huh?
With trad equipment?
Yeah.
No, I don't. It would be tough, you know. I mean, for me, the discipline is the hardest part is being disciplined about, you know, taking the time to set up the shots and make sure your camera's, you know, rolling and all that. And I've been doing a little bit more with the GoPro the last few years, and I've botched up two just awesome shots with a GoPro where I double punch the trigger or double punch mm-hmm. the record button. And, you know, had great footage going right up to the shot. And then I hit record. Then it's like, did I hit record? You know, it's like so I started hitting the gym again here recently, and, you know, running, there's like a 12th of a mile track that goes around the inside of the community center, that new one they just built here. And I actually had to buy myself a lap counter, a little clicker for my hand, because I couldn't count to 24, you know, running around the lap or to get 2 miles in, because it was like I'd go 8 and then go, dang, was that 8? Or was that 9? Or was that 7? Or I usually get to 8 pretty well. But then after 8, I'd lose it. You know, I'd be listening to a podcast the whole time I'm running, so your mind would start to drift. And then you'd come around that lap, and it's like, dang it. So the first time I ran with a lap counter, I was like, all right, I'm going to keep track in my head, and then I'm going to check it periodically against the lap counter. And I did not get one lap right. I mean, it was like pathetic. I checked like 5 times, and I'd be off as much as 2 laps. And it was just like, oh my goodness, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, so you need someone else pushing that record button.
I do. Yep. I am not responsible enough to keep track of whether it's awesome. Recording or not recording. Clearly. Yep. So, well, right on, guys. I appreciate your time here this evening, and I think we cranked out a good one. It'll help guys that are interested in getting their ILFs tuned up, getting it set up, and guys that are kind of on the fence or scratching their head about which route to go, I think this will be a lot of good information for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And for your listener base, go on to our YouTube channel, The Push Archery, and give us a subscribe. We will be coming out this month with two new videos that kind of go along with this conversation that we just had, one of which is we have now, between Tim and I, we have basically all of South's bow models, bow line. We have a Wolverine, a Coyote, a Dingo, and the new Stalker Apex ILF, and we're going to be doing a full review of each one of those bow models, talking about the specifics, showing a lot of B-roll of us shooting them, showing them in the turkey woods, just basically talking about all of our initial impressions on these rigs and why we choose to shoot the Stalker bowline. And then also we're going to be doing a how-to/beginner-to-ILF video as well. So that's going to go hand in hand. It's going to kind of go through a little bit of the details on, hey, you got your ILF bow. Here it is in the box in front of you. What do you do with it? So be watching for those coming out in April.
We're also going to be doing a truck etiquette video on how to properly transport your bow in a pickup truck.
Yeah.
Mine will be in the truck bed. It will not happen.
Yeah. Sal, did you by chance see on our social media feed that picture I posted with a drill and a drill bit and tap?
I was just going to comment about that one, man. You've raised quite a hubbub there.
Holy crap. I mean, I you would have swore my firstborn child was laying down on my workbench and I was about to hurt him.
Yeah, with the freezer paper and the butcher knives there, huh?
Right. Oh man, we can say with certainty right now that modifying a custom wooden bow is not supported very well in the traditional community.
Not PC. Yeah, I got to admit, man, every time somebody asks me to drill quiver inserts into their riser, I tear up a bit.
That's funny. If you guys want to check out, I'm going to plug ourselves here real quick, Sal. If you want to check out what we're just talking about, our Instagram is The Push Archery, at The Push Archery, and our Facebook is The Push Archery. It's real simple. All of our media content outlets are all the same, but yeah, you can go on and check out that post. It's pretty funny. A lot of people were pretty riled up about that.
Yeah. No, that was a classic for sure. Oh, good deal. All right, guys. Well, I appreciate it. And I'm going to turn in. I got a 4 a.m. wake up call to start building bows again. So it's kind of getting past my bedtime here already.
All right, brother.
All right. Thanks for having us on, South.
Hey, sure thing.
On the other side of the hill, buddy.
Yep. All right. Appreciate it, guys.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe to the show so that you will automatically be notified when new episodes are posted up. Please take the time to give us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about or a guest that you'd like to hear from in a future episode, email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. Too many years are passing by. I come down by.